How self-indulgent can you be to think that you can do this kind of killing and get away with it?
Yeah.
To be able to do it and to continue to do it. A couple of days ago, they've destroyed the last standing university.
Yes.
Yeah.
They've destroyed all the hospitals. They've destroyed all the schools. And they've been killing all the people they've been killing. I don't know how many have been injured, how many of the injured are mutilated permanently. I mean, yeah. It's so glaringly obvious that a glimmer of peace in the Middle East is impossible without negotiation. And yet, you keep feeding the Israelis the means of thinking a utopia that they can actually set themselves in the future, yeah, simply through sheer force and through obliterating, yeah, people they disagree with.
Welcome, everyone, to an English episode of The Verbranders, a podcast on Europe's borders and resistance against them. I'm Neske Baarwald.
And I am Wiebe Ruitenberg.
The Verbranders is Dutch for Haraga, an Arabic word used in Tunisia, Algeria, and Morocco. Haraga literally means those who burn, and is used to speak of people who cross European borders without permission. It refers to the burning of identity papers. Those who do Haraga seek life, and in doing so, burn Europe's borders. Our guest today is Ghassan Haj, a professor of anthropology at the University of Melbourne in Australia. Today we talk with Ghassan, not about Europe's borders, but about Palestine, and the intensification of the destruction of life in Gaza at the hands of the Israeli state and the powers that support it. We recorded our conversation a few weeks ago, in January 2024. And as I record this introduction, I'm struck by how difficult it is to find words that speak to the moment we are in. We're witnessing military attacks of unimaginable brutality, with countless bodies still to be found under the rubble. Alongside this obliteration of Palestinian life, we see the destruction of the conditions of possibility for life, with the bombing of water wells, greenhouses, food depots, ports, fishing boats, hospitals, schools, and bakeries. This violence is not new, but an intensification of the structural settler colonial violence inflicted upon the Palestinians for the past 76 years and more. We must pause and reflect on the histories that made it possible for Gaza to become the place it is today. A place where Israel can cut off the supply of water, food and electricity to Gaza, turning hunger and thirst into weapons of war. As Ghassan points out, violence is inherent in the very existence of Gaza. Where does the legitimacy of such violence come from? How do we accept living in a world where it is normalized? Ghassan identifies the root of the problem as the virtual absence of the very thought of negotiating one's existence with others, creating the fantasy in Israel that supremacy over everyone is possible. This fantasy is fueled by a frightening racism that makes it such that Palestinians can be treated as if their death is meaningless. In the episode, Ghassan describes Israel as an ethno-racial state and as a meta-colony, a colonialism of all colonial powers. This means responsibility lies not only with the Israeli government, but also with the meta-colonial powers that make this destruction possible in the form of massive military aid and diplomatic support. And we must dig deeper and think about the global infrastructures in place that provide the materials and cover necessary to sustain this onslaught and find ways to challenge it. One final note before we play our interview. We recorded this episode on January 19th, before the news came out that the Max Planck Institute fired Ghassan after journalists from the right-wing newspaper Welt am Sonntag labeled his Facebook posts on the destruction of life in Palestine as anti-Semitic. We want to express our support for Ghassan. As Les Beck wrote, scholarship is nothing unless it confronts the world as it is, honestly and with open-minded criticality, as people like Ghassan have always done. but we also want to highlight that Ghassan's firing forms part of a much longer history and a broad repertoire of silencing that is not new or unique to Ghassan or to Germany. And at the same time, many departments and scholars in Germany value and support Ghassan's work, as do many Israeli scholars, Palestinian scholars, and scholars all over the world. We close this episode with a reflection on the future. Israel, as an ethno-racial state, is going to come to an end. The question is, what kind of an end? Tragically, with massacres and counter-massacres, or through a negotiated mode of existence, where everyone can live together? Let us work towards the latter. Welcome, Ghassan. Thank you for joining us to the podcast.
A pleasure to be here.
We're here to talk about your work on Palestine, your work on racisms, on nationalisms, and we're here to make sense of, I guess, the moment that we're speaking in today. We are recording this in January 2024, and we are collectively witnessing an intense round of violence in Palestine. And I guess, given that you've been engaging with these questions, with the question of Palestine for decades, we're really honored and curious to think through this intense situation together to the extent that it is possible.
Yeah, it might be helpful for me as well to try and think of it. Yeah.
Let's try. As a first question, we were wondering if you could introduce yourself a little bit and talk about your entry point into thinking about Palestine.
Yeah, it might come as a bit of surprise for people, but my entry point into Palestine was more as an anti-Palestinian, in the sense that I grew up in a Christian Lebanese Maronite environment in the 1960s and early 70s, when there was an intensification of conflicts between the Palestinians and the Christian Lebanese in the form of right-wing politics. And yeah, I grew up until the Lebanese Civil War in 1975. Yeah, so I was part of, inherited the kind of like hatred of the Palestinians that was common in that culture, uncritically, kind of. And yes, so 2 years after the Civil War, I left to Australia. And this is where things started changing. But interestingly, the change was linked to the fact that even though I was anti-Palestinian in Lebanon, in a kind of like not really thought out way, just thinking the Palestinians are out to get us, kind of like this kind of. Yeah, I was quite radical culturally. And in terms of my involvement in counterculture, music, but also against cultural norms, conservative cultural norms, etc. So we were quite an unusual group in Lebanon. And we were all listeners to music that was quite progressive in a Western sense. Particularly, we were all fans of Frank Zappa. And when I went to Australia, immediately at university, I started looking for people who, you know, like, it was a big thing. Do you understand Frank Zappa or don't you understand Frank Zappa? Sort of like, it was a kind of, actually, at one point, there was an Australian reporter who had asked me, how did you integrate when you came to Australia? And I said, I didn't have a sense of Australians, Lebanese. The world was divided between people who understood Frank Zappa and people who didn't understand Frank Zappa. This was much more important for me as a division. Anyway, so what was interesting was that the people who understood Frank Zappa were much more leftist in Australia, in the West in general. So they introduced me and I became part of this Western culture. And at the same time, I was reading about Marxism, colonialism, and I kind of like shifted to a more general anti-colonial, anti-imperialist thing, but didn't really center it on Palestine.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It was just like any Western radical student being radicalized. Palestine did not have, and I think as a matter of fact, for some time, the two coexisted together, sort of like me being anti-imperialist and etc., and me thinking the Palestinians were out to get.
Yeah. And in some circles, it still coexists together.
Of being progressive and not. I mean, that's one of the curses that helps make Gaza what it is today, I think. There's no doubt.
Exactly.
But yeah. I think an important shift is when you start feeling effectively that it's not just some politics and some Marxist thinking or good position, etc., but you feel some kind of empathy with the people who have been hurt by colonialism and by imperialism in general. So that's one point of entry. Another important point of entry is that my partner's father is an Italian Jew who had to escape Mussolini. And so I had to engage with her family and with the fact that we had to debate Palestine all the time. And so it was very interesting for me, sort of the fact that both sides of my family, my own family and Caroline, my partner's family, were not exactly sort of like environments where pro-Palestinians sort of like flourished. But at the same time, it made it central to think it.
Because you had to relate to it.
Yes.
Yeah.
And can I ask you about this shift towards feeling the people affected? When did that shift occur for you and what set that in motion?
I don't know if I can say when, but I can definitely have a sense of it as a deeper and more significant positioning in the world. In the sense that I come from a middle-class background, and the first thing that I enjoyed about Marxism was that it was almost like mathematics. That it kind of like pleased me as a logic. It allowed me to understand things. But when you start feeling for people, it's a much more radical break with your middle-class culture.
I think there's also a moment, because you mentioned empathy, but there's also maybe a moment where you start hurting yourself when you see what's happening, and it starts to not only be empathy, but you feel attacked yourself, right?
Yes.
I think that's also in some of your work you write about feeling like that.
Yes, that's very important, that moment where, you know, I mean, because there's on one hand, like historical arguments about Palestine and sort of like, did the Jews have the right for Palestine or did they not? Did they come as colonialists or did they not? So you can have this intellectualist debate. But at the same time, Israel's humiliation of Palestinians is there for you to see. It's not a historical event.
Yeah.
And this is even more so now. Yeah. This idea that that there are other human beings in the world that can be treated as if their death is totally meaningless.
Yeah.
It's outrageous. And it's outrageous that not many feel it's outrageous.
And that's part of this thing that we're all working through. Our capacity to not feel it also. Yeah. And I'm saying our as a human beings or both our capacity to feel it, to live inside each other or to live mutually and to shut that out.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, I think there are many of us who do, which is a great thing.
And so I'm paraphrasing you right, but this shift when the question of Palestine starts to enter not only your sort of analytical mind, but also your emotions. What then happened to your kind of think, because you cannot separate these also, right? Like they are separate, but you cannot separate them. So what then happened to your thinking about the work that you were doing, the research that you were doing, as Palestine becomes a question or another kind of question, maybe?
Yes, I mean, I think you start centering Palestine yourself and start thinking everything in terms of how it relates to Palestine. But then you have to kind of like get to a moment where you start thinking, well, is it because of your emotions that you are centering Palestine and judging everything in relation to Palestine? Or is it because Palestine itself is such an important nodal point? You know, I think Jacques Lacan, the French psychoanalyst, has this concept of point de capiton, which is, you know, when you have a sofa and there are these kind of buttons that clip the surface of the sofa.
Yes,
those buttons.
Yeah.
It clips the surface to the base.
Yes.
And so these, for him, were like something that clips the meaning of the world to the world.
Mm.
And so when something is a point de capiton, it means it's not just your emotions. It's because this point is so crucial in shaping how we think of the meaningfulness of the world.
Yeah.
And I think Palestine is definitely a point de capiton. It actually is a place not just where you make sense of the Middle East or not, it's where you make sense of the world.
Yeah.
Yeah. What makes it that for you?
Well, it's history. It's the fact that it is the first meta-colony. I think it's a very important thing. In the sense that, you know, you had French colonialism, you had English colonialism, you had Dutch colonialism, etc. But this is a colonialism of all of them. It is the first meta-colony. And its meta-nature came very clearly when it was attacked on the 7th of October. You know, there was no doubt in the eyes of many that, you know, it's no longer an issue of Zionist colonialism. It's Western colonialism taking the form of Zionism. Yeah.
Because everyone jumped in place behind Israel.
Yes.
All of those colonial powers.
And effectively, right?
Yeah, effectively.
In the sense, you know, obviously what happened to the Israelis is awful on the 7th of October, and you should feel it. But it's very hard not to notice that everyone felt it.
Yeah.
And what about all the other things? Why nobody was feeling them? It's very hard to kind of like reconcile. But yeah, but I think it's important to differentiate between the horror of the attack of 7th October and the intensity with which people associated themselves with that horror.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, I don't think I'm saying something new here. Everyone can see sort of like that.
Yeah.
There is a bias in the direction of emotions in thinking the importance of who dies and who does not die.
Yeah. Of course, the internet is full of memes pointing this out, but one of them that I'm now thinking of is a person who reminded all of us how after the Charlie Hebdo attacks, all of these leaders like stood arm in arm to stand up against this horrible attack, and then compared it to the 20,000 plus people who have now been killed in Gaza.
Yeah.
And the silence on it. I mean, it's not pointing out anything that new, but it remains astonishing.
Yeah, I think racism always works like this through selective intensification in the sense that it doesn't necessarily treat non-guilty people and make them guilty, but sometimes it takes guilty people, but it intensifies the guilt around them. I just give you an example from, you know, a Palestinian doctor was found guilty of drugging his female patient and sexually abusing them. And there's no doubt that he did it. And there's no doubt that he was a bastard. But when you are reading people's comments about it, you feel that the intensity, when the intensity starts to be not the norm or incommensurate or etc., you start thinking, where does the intensity come from?
It unleashes something.
And maybe just for our listeners, this was in an Australian context, right? Where this doctor was working.
Yeah. I'm talking about in Australia.
And
I mean, so I'm quite happy to join everyone being horrified about what Hamas did on the 7th of October. But I'm not happy to use it as a way of celebrating white supremacy or Jewish supremacy compared to Arab supremacy. I'm not, obviously, which is what it has turned out to be in the end.
Yeah, I think in one of the recent pieces you wrote about this particular moment, you also write how you feel like there's no space for that kind of mourning. There's no space to mourn what happened on the 7th of October and the victims of that.
That's right. That's right. I mean, you come to mourn and you realize this is a festival of supremacy.
Yeah.
The very mourning itself.
Yeah.
Some dead are more important than others. Yeah.
And I wanted to relate it to something else that you write and say quite often, I think, is that you're actually not very comfortable or happy talking about Palestine or Gaza. And yet here we are, and yet here you've been for so long talking about it.
Yes, my mode of talking about Palestine and Gaza by saying I'm not happy to talk about Palestine and Gaza, and then I start talking. But I think because there's so little room for education. I mean, I'm a person who almost dislikes saying something and people saying to me, I agree with you. In the sense of like, I feel, okay, why did I bother sort of like working so hard on writing something since
everyone already agrees.
Like, agree with me, thank you very much. So you, it's kind of like agreeing with you is like an examiner saying you're right or et cetera. So like,
you want
to
move?
I'd like to people to say, okay, you helped me, you triggered my imagination, you helped me think about something, or you may, even if it is by disagreeing with me.
Yeah.
With Palestine and Gaza, I mean, it's a festival of people either agreeing with you or thinking you are terrible.
Yeah.
I am an educationalist. I like to educate. Mm. I like to think that my research leads me and allows me to communicate certain things that allow people to think a little bit harder hearing me than they were thinking before. And doesn't happen much.
We're going to move to talking about this particular moment, but there was one thing that I still wanted to ask about situating you as our guest today, which is also why I mentioned just briefly that this doctor that you mentioned was in Australia. And I wonder if you can reflect a little bit on thinking about Palestine from the particular context of Australia, where you've been working for a long while, and how that sort of shapes also the emotions and the affective ties that you are allowed to have in relation to people who might be otherwise situated and positioned. And I'm thinking in particular of some of the work that you did with the Shia Lebanese in Sydney. And then also I read a piece where you talk about a time that you spent in Ramallah, where you are talking to people who live there and who live with the occupation and who have to have a very different
attitude
to the world.
That covers the wide, wide range of things I've written about. But you know, I mean, being positioned in Australia, it's a stages. Like, I've been in Australia for almost 50 years now, so that's sort of a very long time. So when I started, sort of like being publicly speaking about Palestine, etc. Well, it's quite interesting because I wrote and spoke against white supremacy in Australia publicly before I spoke about Palestine publicly in some ways.
Mm-hmm.
And when I was speaking against white supremacy, I did not meet the kind of venom that I encountered when I started speaking on Palestine.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's a bit like everywhere in the Western world that you kind of like have an experience of you meet people, you know them sometimes for months, for years, and you think everything about them is close to you. And then Palestine comes and everything crumbles.
Yeah. Yeah.
And so you start wanting to understand why you feel alone. You feel, am I the one not understanding fully the effect of anti-Semitism and the Holocaust? So you dig into yourself to try and understand why some lefties sort of like you are not sympathetic. Mm-hmm. But because, I'm not primordially Arabist, as I said, it's not that I grew up in a family which taught me my emotions are Arab. I'm not. In fact, my basic emotions are anti-Arab. I'm a totally colonialist product, so I have to work against my primordial feelings to actually develop this. But anyway, sort of like it's a big shift though, between the times I started when I was alone and now I'm a bit like an elder of a whole group of amazing young men and women in Australia who are writing and fighting against this. So you feel part of a community, and you don't feel alone, and you feel capable of eyeballing people in a completely different way. Mm. Yeah.
And what about this link with Ramallah?
Yes, Ramallah. Well, I mean, I think you're referring to sort of like my critique of a culture of resistance. Mm-hmm. Is that sort of like where, that people sometimes want to escape not just Zionism, but anti-Zionism, because between Zionism and anti-Zionism, you become straitjacketed. So I think the incident you're referring to is when this woman in a house where her husband is a martyr, and there's a bit of a mini shrine for him, and she had kids, and she picked up these Disney comics and took, as she was taking them to bed. And I noticed the Disney comics, and I said, and she said to me, I like to read them some comics like this before they go to bed so they can feel a little bit of normality. And it was interesting, her using a notion of Hayat adiye, sort of like normal. a normal life, because it was as if colonialism and anti-colonialism made the kids sort of like just sitting there, sort of like without any sense of like that you could go to sleep and read the comic. And so I called it heroic normality, in the sense that you really need to struggle to create a bubble where you feel. And that it's healthy for people not to be totally bouncing between colonialism, anti-colonialism. It's exhausting, psychologically damaging. But, I mean, the thing is, how can you escape it in Gaza? forget it. Sort of like when it takes the form it's taking in Gaza, it just envelops you and devours you.
Yeah.
And it's intense work as well to keep life going.
But it's also sort of like not to... Because in the desire not to be colonized, you don't want to surrender all your being to anti-colonialism. It's good to have anti-colonialism, but it's also good to live.
Earlier, we talked a little bit about mourning and how the space for mourning for Israelis who were attacked on October 7th is, I guess, felt like a very shrunk space for a lot of us who maybe even at that moment already could almost see into the future and feel the retaliation coming. So you saw this attack and you knew this retaliation is going to be intense and pounding. And I felt very capable of feeling the pain of the Israelis who were attacked, but I didn't feel like I had a space to express that, because you immediately feel that that space is kind of, or what you're going to say is warped up in a politics that is spinning in a direction that you don't want to be a part of. And so that, and a lot of people were struggling with this and written beautiful pieces about it as well. But I remember vividly the weekend of the bombing campaign that started, so the Israeli bombing campaign of Gaza. And I remember I had to write, I think I had a deadline, so I had to write something, and I couldn't write at all. I was just completely immobilized, sitting there watching, as many of us were, following all of the context that I was following in Gaza, and holding my heart with them as the bombing started, and just for hours and hours watching live on my phone the pounding, and how that pounding started in a context of immense power imbalance. I mean, we don't have
sometimes
to.
Sometimes you have to stop watching.
Absolutely.
But you feel guilty because you're stopping watching, and you have the power to not to watch.
You feel guilty watching. You feel guilty not watching. You feel guilty protesting, because protesting is not enough. But that experience was really intense. And one of the people that I encountered in that particular moment was Rafat Al-Arir. He is an academic, a professor, a poet, an activist, someone whose voice has been important already for many years from Gaza. And he was later killed on December 6th. And in that weekend that I was watching the bombing campaign start, I remember listening to an interview with him. And we were going to maybe play it for you to see if you want to also respond to what he's saying, and to, I guess, this moment.
We know that it's very bleak, it's very dark. There's no way out. If there's no water, there is no way out of Gaza. What should we do? Like, drown? Like, commit mass suicide? Is this what Israel wants? And we're not going to do that. And I was telling some friend the other day that I am an academic. I probably the toughest thing I have at home is an Expo marker. But if the Israelis invade, if they barge at us, charge at us, open door to door to massacre us, I'm going to use that marker, throw it at the Israeli soldiers, even if that is the last thing that I would be able to do. And this is the feeling of everybody. We are helpless. We have nothing to lose.
I think the crucial issue when you hear him, and when you hear anyone from Gaza, really, is to be aware that this is not an event. Yeah. This is a life condition.
Exactly. Mm-hmm.
And because if you think of it, if you think of this violence as, oh, it's happening today, and don't think that this is something you grow up living on a daily, monthly, yearly basis. You will not, because this is what constitutes your subjectivity. It's not, your subjectivity is there, and the violence encounters it. The violence is what constitutes you as a subject in Gaza. This is why Gaza, before today, is a space of criminality. I mean, it has always been a space of criminality. And it's just an intensification of making it a space of criminality. And it takes us to the roots of the problem, which is, how is it that today, in the world we exist, someone is capable of engaging in such violence continuously for years, intensely for the last 3 months, but continuously for years and years and years. We have to ask where the legitimacy for the fact that such violence is exercised comes from. How do we accept to live in a world where it is normalized? You know, because, I mean, the Israelis don't have to, if you are a radical and you think Israel is a settler colonial state, it does not mean the Israelis are going to agree with you.
Yeah.
Okay? I mean, okay, you can think as a radical that they are settler colonial states, but a lot of them don't think that, right? They think they're a state. And to understand them, you have to think they're a state. And then you have to say, well, no state will accept to live with someone next door capable of entering and killing their citizen in the way they did. I don't have a problem understanding that. I mean, it's not hard. I can understand the logic of not wanting to live with the Vans. Now, the next step, though, is that this violence exists because I have already said over 100 years that I don't accept to live with this violence. Yeah. And my solution to not accepting to live with this violence is that I'm going to make sure that my surrounding is totally sterile and unable to do violence towards me. Mm-hmm. And then you try and some violence is done towards you and you say, okay, I'm not accepting this violence. I'm going to be really, really violent to make sure that no one around me can do this violence to me. Yeah. And then they do some more violence to you. And then you say, well, I'm going to be really, 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 really violent this time because I'm going to stop people violence. And it's going on. And then 7th of October happens. Well, you'd think someone would say, okay, well, can we try something else for God's sake? You know, I mean, well, it's sort of like, okay, you don't want to live with the man. And I think it takes us to the total root of the problem, which is that the very thought of negotiating one's existence with others in Israel is absent. This idea is that to negotiate with others, okay, you can hurt me a bit, but I can hurt you a lot, but that's the way of the world. Let's arrive at something. No, if you can hurt me, I cannot negotiate with you. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And this idea is surreal. I mean, it's surreal, and it's surreal that the world gives it legitimacy. Mm-hmm. And you hear it on a daily basis. I mean, now, as we are speaking, Netanyahu says, I don't accept to have a Palestinian state. But he says it in a way as if it wasn't yesterday he was receiving weapons and money in order to be continuing to doing the violence he is doing. Yeah. So I don't know how people put us in this situation where we're supposed to accept that someone who is dependent on the world to do violence looks arrogantly at the world and says to them, I don't, why don't say, okay, well, won't give you any more your weapon. But there is no normalization of the idea, which is basic idea that, well, okay, look, either you kind of like calm down or we're going to stop giving you weapons. Mm-hmm. You know, I'm just a basic human thing. Mm-hmm. But no, the thought does not come to anybody's mind.
You've just articulated something that I hadn't yet. The episode that we recorded just before this episode is called Why No Borders. It was an interview we did with Bridget Anderson, Cynthia Wright, and Nandita Sharma. And in it, Bridget mentioned in passing something that was crucial to the piece that they wrote under the same title. So when you're articulating a no borders politics, you are positioned in the realm of the utopian, which, fair enough, like, there is maybe something utopian to it. But the point that they make and that she makes is borders themselves are utopian. The idea that you can control everybody's movements or control who comes in and out is utopian. So it's a type of utopia that locks you in, and it's a type that to me feels very similar to what you're talking about. Mm. It's this complete negation of the fact that you live together in this world.
Mm. Yeah.
And that part of living together in this world means negotiating that world together. And the work that borders do is constantly create this fantasy of the possibility of control and separation. And it locks you in. And there's a similarity here and a difference, because there's more happening here in Zionism than just this logic. There's more happening than logic anyways, I guess.
But it is utopian. And what is important is that some people think that utopia is within their grasp.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And some people don't.
Yeah.
And I think one of the tragedies of what happens in Israel is that the 1967 war gave Israel a sense that supremacy of everyone is possible. In fact, think about this, sort of like it's the image of a country that is capable of destroying all the armies of all the countries around it in 6 days.
Yeah.
And this is the standard against which Israel judges its own capacity. So if you can't do this, you're failing. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's just like a weird thing to think when you think about it, that a country thinks that unless it can destroy everyone around it in 6 days, it means it's not powerful enough. This is how the citizens of Israel judge their government, right? So now, if you read the Israeli press, the sense of failure is that Hamas has not been totally smashed in 1 day, let alone in 3 months, and that's still capable. So you've been carpet bombing, destroying a whole place.
Yeah.
You've killed something up to 30,000 people, and you feel you are failing.
There's no end to that.
Mm.
Yeah. This is the utopia. And why it's a destructive, self-destructive utopia when you have such standard for yourself and you feel you're failing unless you can just wipe people immediately.
Mm-hmm. I want to ask you about the starting point of not seeing this as an event, but as a sort of continuity, and at the risk of saying something you don't like, but I agree with approaching it like that. And I also see how you speak about 67 and sort of this as almost an outcome, the carpet bombing as an outcome of a mindset that, well, maybe not came into being then, but then became intensified. At the same time, an event like this does also change the facts on the ground. And I think to many of the observers, it's also felt like, you know, there's something changing here. There's something so incredibly violent about this and so total in its destruction that it's not the same after this somehow also.
Yeah, yeah. No, I relate to that. I relate that this feeling is circulating.
Yeah. Well, and do you feel it yourself?
Mm-hmm.
Do you feel it yourself?
Yeah, well, obviously, yes, I do. Yeah. I agree with you too.
Okay.
This is my revenge. I agree with you too. But I still feel that what we are facing is something I've never come across before, historically. So it's a kind of a politics, it's about the conditions of possibility of self-indulgence. I mean, how self-indulgent can you be to think that you can do this kind of killing and get away with it?
Yeah.
To be able to do it and to continue to do it. A couple of days ago, they've destroyed the last standing university.
Yes.
Yeah.
They've destroyed all the hospitals. They've destroyed all the schools. And they've been killing all the people they've been killing. I don't know how many have been injured, how many of the injured are mutilated permanently. I mean, the enormity of this violence, is enormous. But what eclipses it is the enormity of the self-indulgence, and even more so, the enormity of those who don't think we should not allow this self-indulgence to continue.
Mm.
The ongoing support.
Yes. And it's so glaringly obvious that a glimmer of peace in the Middle East is impossible without negotiation.
Mm-hmm.
And yet you keep feeding the Israelis the means of thinking a utopia that they can actually set themselves in the future simply through sheer force. and through obliterating people they disagree with.
Mm-hmm.
And in a very material sense, right? Like the billions of military aid and the endless diplomatic support.
But I'm wondering, because you mentioned you keep on feeding, so I'm also wondering, who is this you that we're talking about? It's probably governments in the West.
I'm talking about the meta-colonials, the meta-colonial assemblage of the European...
But I want to ask you, because you spoke very elusively about maybe the Israeli mindset in this particular moment, but what do you make of the fantasy of maybe these European settler colonial, meta-colonial powers? What is it that they believe when they continue to support this, in your reading?
Frankly, I don't know what they believe, but I know they are bloody racists. I know that they believe, because there is no possibility of understanding how you can think what you are thinking if you are not deeply racist. That is, if you don't deeply think that the value of some human beings is less than the value of some other human beings. It's impossible to think and act the way you do. I mean, Israel has cut the electricity on Gaza. Okay? Yeah. So someone reports Israel has cut the electricity on Gaza. I mean, to me, this sentence, when it's normalized, is so mind-bogglingly itself racist. I mean, like, who would accept to live in conditions where someone else cut their electricity, you know? Yeah. I mean, it's normal as all. Yeah, they cut the electricity in Gaza. They're not allowing food into Gaza. Who among all the people of the world outside Gaza think, oh, I wouldn't mind living in a place where other people can decide whether I get food or not? Oh, I wouldn't mind. Nobody. But they seem to think it's fine for the Palestinians to be living in conditions where the basics of life is controlled by someone who wants to wipe them out. I mean, the enormity of the racism is beyond the imagination.
For sure.
And yet, nobody sort of like seemed to think, well, okay, we need to deal with this. So it's beyond rational argument. I don't believe us speaking about this affects it much. The fact is that either we can weaken the Israelis or we can't. And the fact is, some people might fantasize about bad things happening to Israeli people, but my fantasy is weaken the Israelis so they can negotiate.
Mm.
You know, that's my fantasy. I'm sitting there looking at the world and saying, this is going to end in disaster unless the Israelis learn that they have to negotiate their being with the Palestinians.
Mm-hmm.
A disaster for everyone. So, you know, you stop exporting weapons to them. That's how you weaken them.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, we've got 50 plus years of people saying, I believe in a two-state solution. I mean, how can you not say, well, piss off, you know, either you act for it. I don't want to hear you tell me again how much you believe in a two-state solution. I mean, the Gaza is destroyed, and the U.S. president says, I believe in, you know, really, sort of like, how often is it going to come and hit my head? Sort of like, what have you done, really, to weaken Israel? This is it. I mean, the moment you say the word, it's good to weaken Israel, you are imagining someone who wants to kill every Israeli, anti-Semite, etc., and not think that weakening Israel is a good thing for the people living there.
Mm-hmm.
We have all these people sort of like criminalizing the only people who, in a grassroots situation, are trying to think how to put pressure on Israel, which is the BDS movement.
Yeah.
And you criminalize it. Yeah. Okay, well, you know, at least this movement, you can disagree with it, but it's saying, just like with South Africa, apartheid South Africa, if you don't weaken these people, they're not going to negotiate. And it's going to end nastily. Yeah. It worked with South Africa. I don't mind people not agreeing, but you criminalize it on top of that. And then you say, I'm for a two-state solution. Well, you know, I mean, you'll excuse me if I think this is beyond rationality anymore. Sort of like, you know, there's no space for sitting and arguing logically about what's going on.
Mm-hmm.
The attachment is kind of like visceral. And personally, I think it is deeply linked to the whole fossil fuel mode of existence.
Can you talk a little bit more about that?
Yes, I mean, I've written about this in my book, Is Racism an Environmental Threat? And I think that the essence of the ecological crisis is the inability to manage the effect of your extreme domination. That is, your extreme domination is creating an impact on the world, and you are not able to dominate the impact of your domination, and which weakens your domination. And in a way, our domination of the Earth was based on the idea that we could control waste, control things, etc., which is dominating the effect of your domination. Mm-hmm. That's what controlling waste means. Mm-hmm. But when you can't control waste, it means you cannot dominate the effect of your domination. And I think colonialism is in a similar crisis. The effect of the nation state, that's refugees for me, is the inability to control the effect of the domination of nation-state system. So I think the Australian state, when I compared, this was my starting point, you know, the asylum seekers are arriving by boat, and the language that they were using to describe the asylum seekers were incredibly similar to the language they were using to describe these waves of plastic rubbish arriving. Yeah. Okay. We didn't do this. This is somebody else's problem. It's coming our way.
Yeah.
But you don't say, well, actually, yeah, it is your problem. You created it. You created it through the domination process, and this is the effect of your domination. And so the Israelis want to dominate and still control. It's probably the last modernist utopia in the world, which is that, no, we are going to dominate, and we're going to control the effect of our domination. Yeah.
When you were speaking about weakening the Israeli state and sort of what you're then accused of when you say that, I'm thinking of the, it's a bit of a side note maybe, but I'm thinking of the objections that are made to the chant from the river to the sea. Well, besides that it's totally distracting from the actual issue to object to a chant like that, I'm also always thinking, what does this tell us about the person who's objecting, about their imagination of what it means to free a country from the river to the sea? It means that you think of liberation or freeing something as inherently violent, right? And it to me, it always exposes the thinking that the land can only be free if you get rid of the people there, if you kill the people there, basically.
Yeah.
So for me, it's always like, You're revealing so much of your own thinking when you object to that chant. It's revealing that you don't have another, you cannot imagine another way of liberation than killing.
Yeah.
In my reading.
Yes. But look, I mean, you have to think that Zionism has gone through many historical phases, you know. Like all of us who have studied the Middle East know this, right? So that was the Zionism that came as part of the fantasy of Jewish groups to return to the... But a big leap came when this came packaged as an ethno-racial state.
Yeah.
So there was before Zionism coming, which did not fantasize about having a state, that is, an ethno-racial state. And so, and in that, there was still belief. The people were coming. There was a belief that it's a good thing. It's a good thing to have a Jewish state. At least that was, even though it's a terrible belief, the ethno-racial belief, but at least it's a belief. But when you think of the people who have been arriving in Israel today, it's basically people who think it's an opportunity for a land grab. I mean, it's the last place where you can go and have a land grab. In the colonial eras, sort of like in Australia, sort of like, etc., you go to Australia and you say, indigenous people do not exist, I will do a grab. That's weird enough, but at least like you can try and think it. But that in today's age, there are people who go to a country because they think, I'm going to get a bit of free real estate. I come from the US, but I think it'll be a better life. Yeah, sort of like it's action, army and camaraderie. This is how it's all packaged. So we have to also contextualize that a lot of the jargon of Zionism is an empty shell. As I read in Ireland when I was recently, they had under the Israeli flag, he said, God didn't give you this land, the bloody Brits did. and it's a bit like this. It's a kind of like desublimated. I mean, there is a desublimation of this idea. I mean, God gave us the land. Or I know some people would want to criticize the Israelis, but I think that belief was still at least involves some human fantasy compared to the land grab thing. And I think it affects politics because this emptiness makes for more right-wing politics, not less.
Mm.
This emptiness of ideal, because it becomes justificatory in the way Trumpism is, in the way it's, so, it's part of a whole global politics where people are pursuing base material interest couched
in whatever. So where is this going then?
Great question. If only people listened to me, everything would be fine, right? I feel, you know, as I began by saying, I have, through marriage, but also I've taught so many Israeli students who have become professors in Israel. I have Israeli friends over the years. So maybe because of this, I'm not someone who harbors exterminationist fantasies towards Israelis as such.
Yeah.
But I do feel that this trip they're on is impossible to continue.
Yeah.
I mean, it will come to an end, not in my lifetime, which is not long anymore, but still, not in my lifetime, but it's going to come to an end. I mean, I believe in my analytic power to assert and my knowledge of history to look at what is going on and say with confidence, this cannot go on.
You mean Israel is going to come to an end?
Israel as an ethno-racial state is going to come to an end.
Yes.
It's going to come to the end. The issue is, will it come to an end through a negotiated mode of existence where everyone can live together? Or is it going to come to an end tragically with massacres and counter-massacres? And I fear that Gaza leads us more towards that because Gaza feeds animosity and feeds fantasies of counter-elimination and worry about the future generation of people who are coming out, what kind of fantasies of extermination they're going to harbor. And as we're going to witness yet another round of violence and the only way to deal with this is if I really, really destroy it. Are we going to get to nuclear war? Or what is the next stage of destroying more than they have done today?
So what is intellectual work, or what can it be, as we are located in these places that are just captured by this kind of theater of outrage when Israel is attacked in large parts of the meta-colonial powers? What are we doing then?
Yes, well, I have never had an overinflated sense of the impact of academic work, but I say I have a sense of its importance, and I do it. But I don't feel that what I do, needless to say, has that much of an impact, you know. It seems to me it's beyond statements. All the statements have been made.
Yeah.
Even analyzing Israel is indulging it, mm-hmm. as far as I'm concerned. We've analyzed it. The point is, are we for a negotiated settlement?
Yeah.
If yes, are we for weakening the Israeli state? If you're not for weakening the Israeli state, you're playing bullshit on me.
Mm-hmm.
That's how I would consider it. It's as simple as that.
So that's also where the work should be directed.
It should be directed at creating sensitivities that know that the overflow of statements has a long history of meaninglessness, and that we are not interested in producing yet more statements. Can we create forces that make the Israelis realize that they need to negotiate? If we don't, we lose. And probably we will.
With that beautiful statement on the uselessness of statements.
Well, many Palestinians don't share my pessimism, by the way.
Mm.
I have to sort of like be clear about that. Sometimes when I say this, some Palestinians think I'm just a Western bourgeois thinker who has no sense of how resilient and amazingly capable the Palestinians are. Mm-hmm. I hope I'm wrong, and I hope mm-hmm. they're right.
Mm-hmm.
But I can only produce my knowledge and my feelings from my location.
Kasanash, we want to thank you for...
Thank you for having me.
Thank you so much for sharing your thoughts on this, in this particular moment as well.
Before closing this episode, we would like to return to Refaat Al-Arir, the writer, poet, professor and activist who was killed by an Israeli airstrike on the 6th of December in 2023, along with several members of his family. One of the poems he wrote is called If I Must Die, Let It Become a Tale. It became widely shared and recited at protests all over the world after he was killed. This is the poem, read by Peter Griffin.
If I must die, you must live. To tell my story, to sell my things, to buy a piece of cloth and some strings. Make it white with a long tail, so that a child somewhere in Gaza, while looking heaven in the eye, awaiting his dad who left in a blaze and bid no one farewell, not even to his flesh, not even to himself. Seize the kite, my kite you made, flying up above, and thinks for a moment, an angel is there, bringing back love. If I must die, let it bring hope. Let it be a tale.